Done.
Thanks, Diane.
What we will do, as probably most of you are aware, this is kind of an off day for the legislature, and I have by bending arms and calling in chits, and actually, I have a nice committee that has agreed to be here on this day off to try to finish up three bills. We have one member that is en route, but we will right now treat this as a work session, do the adjustments that we have to do to these three bills, and if we cannot maintain a quorum or get one, we'll the next regular meeting take the final action to vote them out of committee. So present now are Representatives Cott, Representative Phillips, and myself, Representative Porter. We will be dealing with HB 69, registration of sex offenders, HB 64, the anti-stalking law, and HB 100, prosecution of juvenile felons. The first bill that we will take up is HB 69, registration of sex offenders. Ask Gail Horesky, staff counsel, to tell us what we have done to that committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gail Horesky, legal counsel for the committee. Mr. Chairman, we did just a moment ago receive from the drafters a proposed CS for HB 69 relating to sex offenders. I believe that has been also passed out to members of the public. The work draft I'm working off, sir, is 22693.
Well, actually, there are two of those. No, this is
64.
This is 64, so never mind. That's right.
Oh, yeah, 69. And also the work draft 2.6.
Right.
Would you like me to go over the changes that appear in this work draft?
Please.
Referring to the work draft 2.6, Mr. Chairman, the first major change, or the first change of any sort, but appears in section 2 on the bottom of line 1. And you'll remember, Mr. Chairman, that at its last meeting, the committee decided to attach a requirement of giving of blood samples for DNA analysis, but this requirement does not take effect immediately. So what the drafters have done, sir, and this is sort of confusing, section 2 will take effect when the bill passes and contains three elements: failure to register. Failure to register, failed valuable written notice of change of address, or on top of page 2, annual written notice. Now, section 3, Mr. Chairman, is identical to section 2 with the exception on line 6 of a new paragraph 4, supply of blood sample as required, etc. That new section 3 will take effect January 1 of 97, and that is on the very last page of the bill, section 16. It says sections 3 and 6 take effect January 1. So what it would be is the section 2 would take effect, it would remain in effect from its effective date until 1/1/97. Then on 1/1/97, section 2 would be repealed and section 3 in effect would take its place.
With the new
language. As of that date, with the new language, which is in the only difference is in that paragraph 4.
On that point, Mr. Chairman, why don't we have an immediate effective date on the rest of the bill?
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall that anyone has ever suggested that. We do have an immediate effective date on 64. This is the kind of thing that the department would have to gear up for and adopt the regs and that sort of thing, so perhaps that's why they didn't thus far have.
Could we check into that?
Well, Mr. Wolliver is here from the Speaker's office. Perhaps he could comment on that. I'll make a note.
Thanks.
Question. Mr. Chairman, continuing on the changes in the present work draft, we did do a little bit of research, and the general consensus was that municipal did appear to be better than local. DPS law and the legislative drafters all are of that opinion. So in this draft, it does say municipal. The page 3, Mr. Chairman, line 15, duration of sex offender duty to register. This is the main change that was made from last time. And if you'll see there on line 18, the duty to register continues for the lifetime of an offender convicted of Class A or unclassified. And as you may recall from the prior meeting, Mr. Chairman, there are at least eight other states that have a lifetime registration requirement. On line 20, 20-year period following conviction for a Class B or Class C, and that, again, was agreed upon by the committee at the last meeting. And then paragraph 3 ends 10 years after a misdemeanor conviction. And this is 10 years following unconditional discharge, and that would include any probationary or parole period. The new language also appears, Mr. Chairman, on line 24 on page 3. The department shall adopt by regs procedures to notify a sex offender who lists a conviction for an offense which is a violation of a former law or a law of another jurisdiction. The reason that was put in, it was added by the drafters, Mr. Chairman, was if a person comes in from California, for example, he or she may not know what he was convicted of in California. What does that equal in Alaska? And it certainly would be understandable that he or she would not necessarily know that. So we have basically in this draft for the committee's consideration placed upon DPS the responsibility, since they're administering the program, to notify the people. Or they wouldn't have to do it, but they just adopt the regs for how the program works. I mean, maybe DOC could do it, theoretically. But somehow the people should be notified. Is it a 10-year period, is it a 20-year period, or is it a lifetime period? I think that's appropriately fleshed out by reg, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm. Is there any, that's kind of A equals B equals C equals D kind of deal. Do you follow that?
Sort of.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, that's it for changes between the previous work draft, which was
mm-hmm.
dated 224, and this one, which is dated 226. Regarding the DNA portions, Mr. Chairman, if I could just direct the members' attention, there is a paperwork in your file that starts the heading of states with constitutional rights to privacy. We did discover, Mr. Chairman, with a little further research and with the help of the Department of Public Safety, which was very helpful, have found out that there are 21 states, I think, 21 states that we know of, that have adopted DNA laws for sex offenders, in other words, requiring the providing of a blood sample. And our research, Mr. Chairman, has shown that at least 7 of those states, and those are the ones that are checked on the list, also have constitutional rights to privacy, as does Alaska, as you know. So this is not a guarantee that any provision of this sort would be upheld. It is encouraging that other states that also have the right to privacy have, through their own independent analysis, concluded that they have the authority to adopt these laws and, in fact, have adopted them. I would be glad to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? Are there any questions?
You just noticed another change between the 226 work draft and the 224 work draft. We've got different sections. The sections are different.
Yes, ma'am, Mr. Chairman.
Mm-hmm.
Because Section 2 and Section 3 now are the same, except for that one difference, the numbering of all the other sections was changed.
Okay, Section 3 in the old work draft is judgment for sex offense.
Mm-hmm.
Section 3 in the new work draft is failure to register as a sex offender. They have different titles in the sections.
Well, Section 3, Mr. Chairman,
is the new one. Right.
So Section 4 is the old Section 3.
I got it now.
Yeah.
I was just thinking we were missing something.
They had to renumber all the other sections in the new work draft.
Yeah.
Way to deal with this, trying to get the provision in but not becoming effective until that
date.
The cleanest way to do it without having to come back and take other legislative action was to do it this way.
Okay.
Okay, well, Dale's not going anywhere, so if we have any more questions, we can certainly ask them. I know that there were a couple of people who wished to testify. I don't know if it was on 69 or. Yes, Jan Tusi, please come forward. Welcome.
Representative Porter and members of the committee, my name is Jennifer Tusi, and I live in Juneau. And I want to thank you for allowing me to testify. Sex offenders commit the most seriously destructive crimes against society and individuals. While offenders theoretically pay for their actions when they go to jail, their victims pay for the rest of their lives. The victims have to live with emotional upheaval, inability to function, psychological damage, and fear every day. Sex offenders tend to show predatory behavior, and violent sex offenders tend to escalate in violence every time they recidivate. And because of these two things, registration of sex offenders will help protect the innocent from their predatory behavior. It will also help convey the message that society will no longer tolerate this behavior or ignore it. To date, there is no proof that sex offenders can be cured through rehabilitation. They have an addiction like alcoholics. They can't be sent to treatment and assume that they won't recidivate when they come out. Please support this bill and the protection and peace of mind of victims and people, women and children, and help make a statement that this is not okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim. Are there
any
questions?
Questions?
Representative Cutt?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And the only question I have is, are you representing a specific group or yourself?
Thank you.
Jen. Welcome, let the record show that Representative Nordland has joined us. Hope you get your package up.
Yeah, not quite, but it's all the
I hope you're
it's
planning
all the
to
people
drive.
In my office too.
I hope you're planning to drive.
Drive, oh, I can't get out of town?
Oh, I don't know.
Maybe I need to worry about that.
Yeah. Well, we have just heard Gail give us an update on the two or three changes that were made to the work draft. I don't think that there have been any substance changes that we didn't discuss.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it was just making what we discussed work.
Okay.
Do you remember the duration of duration of registration requirement time?
Mm-hmm.
We voted
yeah.
in a three like Washington.
Yeah, I don't have any problem with that.
Okay. Well, with the forum here and that explanation accomplished, I would certainly entertain a motion.
I'll make the motion that we report CS for Hospital 69 Judiciary out of the committee with the individual recommendation.
And zero fiscal notes.
And zero fiscal notes.
Are there objections?
Mr. Chairman, DPS does have a fiscal note, but I don't know if you want to zero it out. It's like 87,000.
Oh, that's right. So that's
which finance can
down
heal.
The road. Sorry, with fiscal notes.
With the fiscal notes. I meant that to say with a positive fiscal note.
Yes, okay. Margo?
I just noticed a technical problem. I wonder if I might bring it.
Certainly, come forward. For the record, tell us again.
For the record, Margo Knute with the Criminal Division of the Department of Law. A local police department reference has slipped by. It's on page 3, line 8.
Yeah. Would the maker of the motion consider that friendly to amend page 3, line 8, local to municipal?
Yes.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Testing my knowledge of procedure, did we just do that correctly, or do we have to do...
I would move that, well, make an amendment to my motion that a new CS be prepared to reflect that change and that we don't attach an amendment to the CS, but rather that it amendment be included in the CS
right.
with the understanding of the committee. That the CS report will appear slightly different than the one we have in front of us.
Without objection, make
object.
It so.
Object.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Object. Withdraw my objection.
we have a brief at ease.
You betcha. We will be at ease for a moment. Do I have a packet on these other three now?
Yeah.
Or just, you know, don't have a
request if there's a, there are uniform rules.
Yeah. No, but that's great.
Yeah,
needs room.
Everybody knows that.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's just a point of canister.
You get you.
Are we back to order?
We are now back tighter than at ease, but not too tight. And ready to hear HB 64 anti-stalking. If we could, I think, repeat the process. We have had testimony on this bill and have had requests for adjustments to the committee substitute, and Ms. Zareski could tell us what they are.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Gail Zareski, Committee Counsel. Mr. Chairman, there have been very few changes made in the work draft. I'd be glad to point them out. I hope all the members have work draft dated 226-93, HB 64.
Hold on just a minute.
It was separate, so it
would have
been
laying on top of.
I don't have it.
Wait a minute.
Now you do.
Now you do.
There you go.
Great, thanks.
On the 226 sample lending work draft, there has been a change in the title, Mr. Chairman. The new language is on line 7 and 8. Extending the maximum period of probation after conviction for a crime and providing for an effective date. Those reflect changes made in the bill, so they, of course, have been included in the title. New language appears, Mr. Chairman, on page 2, line 4. On page 2 in this section, course of conduct, there has been a technical change there to shorten it up. It is correct. Section concern, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at line 26, I apologize. Course of conduct means repeated acts of non-consensual contact involving the victim or a family member. We took out pattern of conduct directed toward the victim that is composed of repeated acts of it. The Department of Law actually said that's way too wordy, you don't need it. Just clean it up, so we asked the drafter to do that. And then there is also on page 2, new language that appears at line 6, at any time during the course of conduct constituting the offense, the defendant possessed a deadly weapon. That is a change the committee requested, Mr. Chairman. What it does, it's one of 6 items, elements. If the person is guilty of stalking in the second degree, which is the base offense, if certain elements are present, it bumps the classification up to a C felony. So a new element that makes it a C felony is possession of a deadly weapon during the offense. That was suggested by the Council on Domestic Violence and by the Network on Domestic Violence, I believe. Then, Mr. Chairman, a family member at the bottom of page 2 and continuing on till page 3. Family member, there's new language there. The old statement said spouse, child, grandparent, parent, sibling. We have added, Mr. Chairman, for the discussion of the committee, uncle, aunt, nephew, or niece of the victim, whether related by blood, marriage, or adoption. This language, Mr. Chairman, is taken from existing law in other places, Title 11 and Title 25. The intent was to clearly cover stepchildren, adopted children, mothers-in-law. You know, if you're related by blood or marriage in those degrees, then that would include family. Mm-hmm. And then on page 3, line 4 and 5, also among family members is person who is a former spouse of the victim or is or has been in a dating, courtship, or engagement relationship with the victim. Often, Mr. Chairman, in stalking situations, people other than the victim may be targeted, and it may be a current boyfriend who's also being targeted by the stalker. It could be a child that's covered. It could also be a former spouse and a child of the victim with whom she maintains a relationship because of the child that they share, but he's not married to her anymore. And the intent was to cover everybody within this definition who we could think of would logically be an object or a target of a stalker. And again, this is from existing law. This is right now in Title 25, which was amended last year. That's the domestic violence restraining order.
Certainly. On that point, Representative.
Yeah, doesn't that person then, by definition, become a victim? I mean, is all this really necessary?
Mr. Chairman, very good question. If you look at the elements of the offense for stalking, which is on page 2, line 21, person commits the crime of stalking if the person knowingly engages in a course of conduct that places another person in fear for themselves or in fear of death or physical injury to a family member. So if a woman breaks up with her boyfriend and he is stalking her, that's an offense.
Mm-hmm.
But if he is making threats toward her child,
right,
that is a form of stalking as well, and not even unusual.
Right, but I'm just saying then the stalker is stalking another individual, and that person, the child, is...
He's not stalking the child, he's stalking the woman. He's making threats against the child.
I see. Okay.
You don't date me, I'll do this. You know.
I see.
You don't
okay.
do
I
that.
See. All right. All right.
Sounds bizarre, but it's
right.
not
yeah.
uncommon.
If the action was directed towards the child,
then that
would be the victim.
Right.
This is, if you don't do something or whatever, I'm going to do something to a family member.
I understand.
And we wanted to include as many people as possible so that we didn't leave an opening
mm-hmm.
for them to say, well, I'm going to do something to this person, and you'd better do what I want, and that person isn't covered as a
right.
family member, and then it doesn't
okay.
make any sense.
Mr. Chairman, moving on, I'm pointing out only the changes, of course. On page 4 of the work draft, lines 3 and 4, limitation to place another person in fear. This is a change to the assault statute. It's not stalking, it's assault. And the language, physical injury to the person or the person's family member. That used to say immediate family, and we put in family member there so that it was consistent with the stalking. And then they also, section 3 is new. It's basically saying what person's family member means. And it's word for word the same as the definition in stalk. It's more along the lines of a technical amendment.
So this isn't too confusing. We're amending the assault statute.
Yes, sir. And if you look at page 4, lines 23 and 26, that's the existing law, which is terroristic threatening. So basically, the 4 lines from line 23 to 26 are being moved up to lines 3 through 5. Nothing more than that.
There's a relationship between terroristic threatening, stalking, and assault. What this does is make them all compatible and not contradictory.
And Mr. Chairman, the final changes appear on the last page of the bill, section 8. You recall, I believe, sir, the first draft had suggested changing the probationary period to 99 years, but for stalking only. This suggested change extends the present period of probation, which for everything, murder and everything, is 5 years, makes it a possible cap of 10 for everything, and the judge is still free to give 1 year or none, obviously up to the judge. But this change, because it's a change to 1255.090, would apply to all crimes. So it would murder, rape, robbery, manslaughter, you name it. And again, this is not required, it's permission to the court to do it in appropriate cases. Applicability section, there is new language there on line 22 through 24, to the extent a previous conviction is an element of the offense, that previous conviction may have occurred before the effective date of the act. One of the ways that you can be brought up from a misdemeanor offense to a felony is if you've been convicted before of stalking or other things. And this clarifying provision makes it clear that the things that have happened before can be counted to get you to be a second offender. That's a clear way to say it. We added an immediate effective date, Mr. Chairman. That's in section 11. And that's it for changes.
Okay, are there any questions again? President Cobb?
Just the... through the chair, actually just a comment more than anything else. If there is a current piece of legislation that I believe is still in the Senate of extending the period of probation from 5 years to 10 years, if I were opposed to that piece of legislation, I in essence am opposed to this stalking bill. That's what we're doing by including this extension in here. And for lack of any better reason for opposing the extension on probation, I think there's been a recent report that's indicated that the majority of people that are now new clients to the correctional system are in there because of a violation of probation. I haven't looked at it in detail, but I'm not sure I'd be willing to extend probation in general to 10 years for every crime. Just a general comment. I'm sure.
Well, I think by way of, of explanation to a very legitimate point.
I mean, I'm sure that would have come up during the discussion of the other piece of legislation. There may be a legitimate explanation. I'm not sure of it right now.
Well, you recall when the bill was drafted, that provision extended the potential, again, I emphasize potential, for probation to 99 years. The idea for thinking in those terms is that there are people who fall into patterns of committing these types of crimes that need to be deterred from continuing them once they are ready to come back on the street. Because some of them, like we heard testimony about from, I believe, Sergeant Buck Adams and his wife in Anchorage, I happen to be familiar with that case. The individual that they're describing as stalking them is of a mental fixation that probably would be desirous of continuing that harassment if he were placed in an institution for 5 years and came right back out. He's that
focused.
Right now, he's that focused on doing that. Perhaps he could be motivated into not doing that if they said, if you do that again, we're going to have, that was why, 99 years to put you back in for it. We will control your activities for 99 years, and if you violate, you're going back in. Now, maybe that would provide the incentive that you need to stop that pattern of behavior. The problem that the Department of Law and others had with the 99-year provision was that it's very hard to justify allowing that for one individual offense when we have murders and all sorts of things that don't provide for that. So, opportunity for deterrent. The balancing, if you will, of an obvious opportunity for need, but trying to make the whole body of law consistent, was to change the opportunity, not the requirement, but the opportunity for duration of probation from 5 to 10. I would suggest that probably the amount of logic going into the considerations for probation that are being administered now for all the other statutes would probably remain constant. there may be one that may be terroristic threatening, but I would think this and perhaps a couple of the sex crimes would be the only ones that could lend themselves to people who are this focused or this hard to change their pattern of behavior. It would fall into really impacting the system with additional time of probation and consequent violations. And, you know, it's a judgment call. But in any event, Representative Close.
I just had one question on in the title and on section section 2 relating to statutes 1141-221, the statutes amending the assault title or assault statute.
Mm-hmm.
Is that title tight enough relating crime of assault in the third degree? It's just, it's a technical, I don't know the answer whether or not the title's tight enough there.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, it's accurate. If there's a concern that someone in the other body would try to hook other stuff on, I suppose that we could be more specific.
It might come back to us. I just don't know. I don't personally have a problem with it. It seems to me it covers it.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to raise the question.
Well, it has to be included.
Yeah.
Because that's what
right.
we're doing. But
right.
Sometimes you want to be tight, but you don't want the title to be so wordy that.
Exactly.
You know, I can't anticipate.
Let's leave it for now.
Somebody wanting to mess with the elements of third degree.
Yeah.
For grins. So.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You bet. I see that there's no one signed up. Is there anyone that hasn't perhaps signed up that would like to testify on HB 64? Anti-stalking? We've heard several amount of testimony.
Representative Chairman, is there an additional fiscal amount from corrections, or is this the only one dated 219? With a zero fiscal amount? I'm certainly not opposed to the legislation stands. Mm-hmm. Comments on the bottom of this particular fiscal note that suggests there should be something other than zero.
Mm-hmm.
Is there responsible on your part?
I mean, if I'm missing a fiscal note, then I apologize. But there's an anomaly here in this fiscal note.
Yeah.
Unless we're getting free probation officers.
We should put that with our comments going to finance, that,
mm-hmm.
that the Department of Corrections needs to tighten up on their fiscal note.
Yeah. We have I hate to spring it on him, but we have the Department of Corrections standing by on the next case that we're going to be hearing. If there are any questions of them, and we anticipate that we would be able to do that. If I think that it's appropriate to deal with that, but I think perhaps finance would be a better place to do it than here.
Could we just have a question of them, if they wouldn't mind?
Of
corrections?
Sure. Tell you what we'll do. Let's hold action on this bill in advance. We'll start the next bill. My intent is that I will ask for a motion on this bill as soon as we get that question asked and answered, which I think will come up during the time of the next bill. Okay. And if it doesn't, we'll do it anyway. Are you going
to? I'm going to have to leave in about 10 minutes.
Are you?
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to make a motion on this.
Okay.
Sure.
I move that we move committee substitute for CS for House Bill 64 out of judiciary with individual recommendations and request that the Department of Corrections provide an amended fiscal note to the Finance Committee.
You want to do that as a letter of
intent? The second part can be a letter of intent.
Very good.
The first part of my motion will be to move it out with individual recommendations. And then that we send a letter of intent along with our committee report to finance.
Addressing the inconsistency
fiscal.
In
right.
their fiscal note. Is there objection? Seeing none, that is done. And we can now whether we do or do not need to call corrections, take up HB 100. With the same general procedure, we have heard testimony on 100, and we'll ask Gail Horesky to tell us what we remember.
Mr. Chairman, we, for the record, Gail Horesky, Committee Counsel. We have heard this bill before, Mr. Chairman, and there is a work draft which was passed out at the previous meeting. It's dated 2/22. It's just a real small, for discussion purposes, proposed committee substitute. And what we also have, Mr. Chairman, is the sponsor's original bill, which is HB 100. So we have two versions, if you will, for discussion. The first is the sponsor's original version, which sets up basically a scheme to transfer them into adult court for certain offenses, but allows a transfer back if the child, the juvenile, could show that he or she is amenable to treatment. The burden of proof is on the juvenile. There would, according to the Department of Law, end up being a hearing in every case, which is true now, in every case in which they want to waive. The proposed CS, Mr. Chairman, is what might be termed, for just for lay purposes and understanding, an automatic waiver. If you're charged, Mr. Chairman, under that CS with 16 or older and with an unclassified felony or a Class A felony, you are basically moved into adult court and you are treated as an adult, and the provisions of Title 47 regarding juveniles don't apply. This is a simple, straightforward proposal. It's narrower than the original proposal, and the mechanism works differently. You may be aware, Mr. Chairman, that there is also a Senate bill on this topic. Senate Bill 54 has been reported out of the Judiciary Committee.
Is it identical?
It's not identical to either of these versions. It's closer to 100.
And remarkably, it started out looking just like the committee substitute that we have, but
very close.
But was amended to put in what I will privilege the chair, I guess, to tell you to me is not the appropriate way to approach this piece of legislation. And if you will allow me, I'll tell you. The idea of this piece of legislation is to get juveniles of whatever age we decide we want to drop down to. We've heard discussions of 14 and 15, but right now we're dealing with a bill that provides for 16 and 17 year olds. But if they commit or are charged with committing a serious offense, murder, Class A felonies, they should be treated like adults. The idea being one that this knowledge beforehand will perhaps deter some offenses from occurring, because there are people who would indicate, as I will, that there are at least some juveniles who feel that they are immune from any consideration of the criminal justice system because of their status as juveniles and not being able to be seriously dealt with, or as their acts, consequently. Knowing that they would be treated like adults can, in some cases, deter these crimes from happening. So with that as a foundation, we have two approaches to trying to accomplish this. One is that, assuming now that we are talking to a young man and woman who is thinking along these lines and wants to consider committing a crime, under the committee substitute that I am asking you to consider, one would be able to say to that young person, if you do this crime, you will be treated as an adult, and you will be in an adult in court, and you will, if convicted, go to jail for the presumptive sentencing times that would accrue to any adult. Under SB 100, which is in front of us, you wouldn't be able to say it that clearly. What you would say is that we will consider that you committed this crime as an adult, but you may petition the court to tell us why you think you should be treated not like an adult, but like a juvenile. So in terms of trying to create legislation that does not adversely impact the budgets and time allowed for the process of the administration of justice, 100 to me has an automatic additional court proceeding built into it. No attorney, in my mind, would not petition the court if they were defending a juvenile charged with this kind of an offense, would not petition the court for a hearing to try to establish that they should be treated as a juvenile. So, in effect, you have built in an automatic waiver hearing, an automatic extension of time, an automatic extension of budgets, and unfortunately then, the ability of a juvenile to say, nah, there's no guarantee that I'm going to be treated like an adult, so maybe I'd rethink this.
Mr. Chairman, have you discussed this with the sponsor of this 100?
I have. The sponsor of 100 has indicated to me that he would like to not himself tell us to make this switch, but after this discussion, which I've had with him, if it is our desire to do so, he would not object to that. Now, I can only guess at what's going on in the Senate. As relates to this bill, a lot of other things, but as relates to this bill, I can only guess, and it would appear to me that it was a function of required votes to get it out, that they needed to add some amendments, and so they have, while they started, SB 54 started very close to the clean, straightforward automatic waiver that I'm proposing to you. It was amended to look more like 100 in terms of adding automatic waivers. Gail, could you go through 100, if you remember.
In the present version?
Sure.
Yeah.
That's 222?
Well, is that House Bill 100 itself was the one that Representative Bundy introduced, and that stated 129. Mr. Chairman, that refers, it applies to, 15, 16, and 17-year-olds who have, and this appears on page one, who have committed murder or attempted murder, or they've committed unclassified or Class A and have been previously adjudicated for a felony, or they are charged with a felony and have been previously adjudicated as an adult for a felony. If any of those three combinations of events has occurred, then, and this is on page two, the minor shall be charged, prosecuted, and sentenced in the same manner as an adult unless ordered otherwise under H through K of the section. And if you go down and look at that, it says the minor can file a petition within 10 days that he's charged saying that he's amenable to treatment or that the statements, the allegations in the sworn statement are not true. Allegations being you have been previously convicted of a felony as an adult, for example. And so basically, in every case in which jurisdiction is presumptively waived under G, the juvenile can petition the court under H, and that's for all of them, murder and all of them. So that's how it would work procedurally, Mr. Chairman. The rest of the bill goes on to talk about current improvement, psychiatric, and all this. But.
Mr. Chairman, would you clarify something for me, please?
Mm-hmm.
The CS that we have in front of us dated 222.
Yes.
Does that take out the waiver? Does this take out the waiver capabilities that you were just enumerating?
Mr. Chairman, what this does is set up a, quote, automatic waiver for 16 and 17-year-olds, not under original 100, it was 15-year-olds. This is 16 and 17. And it's only for unclassifieds or Class A. But under the proposed CS, if you meet those requirements, if you're 17 and you're charged with murder, boom, you're in adult court and you're staying there. You don't go back. Even if you're, like, if you're charged with first-degree murder and you're convicted of second, for example, you are sentenced in adult court for second degree or manslaughter, whatever it was that you were. You don't go back to juvenile court, and you don't petition to go back before your trial either because it's not allowed. You're just in adult court.
Yes would be an unfair answer, but with that,
right, for six,
the answer is yes.
Anybody
yeah.
over 16?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, the waiver is the waiver into adult court. Maybe mm-hmm. I'm getting confused. And the waiver is in here. He can't transfer back
yeah.
to juvenile
yeah.
court.
President Cutts.
So in a case that was presented before us when we addressed the original bill of the girl who was 17 and killed her parents, there are no mitigating factors now that are looked at, like, i.e., she's been molested by her parents for 28 years or 17 years or whatever the case might be. There's no opportunity now to attempt petition the court to be tried in juvenile.
Mr. Chairman, the screening and charging for adult offenses is done by the Department of Law in Alaska, and the screening and charging of juvenile offenders is done in Alaska by the Department of Health and Social Services. So when something happens, in this case, a youngster kills their parents, what happens is HESS gets involved in that case and takes custody of the child in that kind of a serious situation they would. Well, they have to decide who that, what that person should be charged with, and they often will consult with law on that, I think. I mean, I know they work with the AGs. But if the person isn't charged with an unclassified or a Class A felony, none of this stuff falls into place. So in the circumstance that you brought up, if the youngster was charged with manslaughter, or if she had a defense, like self-defense, or if there was a factual situation that in the mind of the attorney screening the case said, this isn't murder. I mean, I don't know what it is, maybe it's manslaughter, this isn't murder. If she's not charged with murder, none of this applies. So, Mr. Chairman, really, there is a screening mechanism to decide to charge. This bill does not affect that screening mechanism at all. Because something happened doesn't mean the child is charged. The child is charged when, in this case, the Department of HESS and the Department of Law agree what she should be charged with, and then a formal petition is filed against her. And she, the child, has attorneys, too, in both adult and. So if they feel like the case is not being, that the charge isn't correct or the case isn't being handled properly, then there are certainly forums where they say, wait a minute here. If the charge is made, then the case is handled in adult court. Now, in adult court, the person could be acquitted, I mean, theoretically,
right.
Depending on what the facts were, of course. And if they were, then they would be not held at all.
Just to that point, certainly, until there's actually a trial, though, all those facts may not be known until there's a full airing of the whole situation that led to the crime. There may not be enough information at the disposal of the folks in the Department of Health and Social Services to know whether or not this really was a manslaughter. It may appear to be a pure malicious murder with no background information. And the trial might come forward, it might come out that there were reasons why that child might have been, threatened, or might have been, self-defense or manslaughter or whatever. So, I mean, it's just, but at that point, it's too late. At that point, the child's already in adult court, and these facts are coming out, and certainly, there's a chance the child could be acquitted, but there's also a chance the child could be convicted. And
Mr. Chairman, there are representatives here from the Department of Health, which
right.
may better be able to, answer that question. There is an investigation conducted for all criminal cases, and so there are police reports. Certainly, at trial, it is possible that new information is offered by the defense, and that, that happens frequently. But no charges would be filed, whether against an adult or a child, without an investigation and a police report and an interview and, all of that stuff. So, but it's specifically, procedurally, how does it work within HESS and how they work with law, and that it may be that some of the representatives of the department could answer that.
Is perhaps this would be helpful. When does under the committee substitute approach, when would a attorney be assigned to a 16-year-old charged with murder? At what stage of the proceeding?
At the equivalent of arraignment, I believe. But I really think you probably should be asking these questions of. I've never worked for HESS, so I can't tell you, what their internal procedures.
Well, let me ask you this, because this is more of a Department of Law question, I guess, in this situation. If the fact situation is that a 16-year-old is probably responsible for the death of someone, and under this statute, if it were in place, the committee substitute statute, if it were in place, it is a juvenile, and what I'm trying to get at is when is that decision made on charging? I would presume that the first approach of a law enforcement agency would have to be to treat him like a juvenile until the decision was made to charge.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I can tell you that.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to get at.
Yes,
right.
Yes.
So that the protections of a juvenile at the time when
those facts need to be developed would be there, would be in place. And this statute of automatically waiving them to adult court, automatically shifting them to adult court, wouldn't go into effect until that decision to charge for one of those most serious crimes had been made. So
it goes into effect when the DA charges,
right,
files adult charges,
right,
in,
right,
Superior Court. That's
so
what, that's what
if the crime indicates that that's a possibility, it's just that, a possibility. And they would be at, if they had to be taken into custody, they would be at a juvenile facility, not an adult facility. They'd be within the Department of Health and Social Services considerations and all of that. And if, with, if necessary, or requested, legal protection besides. And then they can make their decisions with legal assistance or with whatever on how much information they want to put out to guide them into the decision of which court they consider. But that was the point, I guess, is that by passing this, it doesn't mean if they commit an act that could be that they're automatically considered adults. They're not considered adults until
they're charged.
The time of charging.
Yeah. I understand. Yeah. But those charges are brought about very expeditiously.
Mm.
Well,
no, I can, if I may.
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry, I have to go, but I would like to hear, I would feel greater comfort level if I knew what was involved in the Department of Health and Social Services when they would, how much investigation they do.
Oh, they're here.
They're
here. We need to ask them.
Okay.
That's
sure.
All,
yeah. All right. If you got, yeah, I got.
Sure. Please,
Mr. Chairman, thank
for
you.
For the record.
My name is Randall Hines. I'm the Corrections Specialist with the Department of Health and Social Services.
Well, first let me ask you, was my description of what probably would happen if this statute, the committed substitute of an automatic waiver were in place, would that not be your understanding of how a juvenile would be treated if a 16-year-old were probably responsible for the death of another person? But they would be treated, even with the statute in place, as a juvenile until they were the decision for charging?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. A point of clarification for the committee members. When a kid is, when a child is, or a minor is referred to us from a law enforcement agency on a charge, normally there's a police report accompanying that referral. And the intake officers will screen that and determine what kinds of pieces of information are missing and round that up from various law enforcement agencies. And then they will sit down with the human services folks in the Attorney General's office and review what exactly the charge will be that we brought forward into court. Now, if a kid's in custody, meaning in the detention facility, locked up, then the time starts running with a 48-hour clock. You have 48 hours to arraign them or release them, one of those two things. If they're not, if they're out at large, then there's more time that could elapse potentially for determining what charge actually would be filed on a petition. So that in general is how it works.
So you have a 48-hour period to make the decision on a charge?
Through the chair. If the kid is locked up in custody, then the clock starts
running. Assuming the kid is murdered, his parents would be locked up in custody.
Right.
Yeah.
The exception to that, Mr. Chairman, would be arraignment could be continued if the accused was incapacitated in some way. Sometimes kids come in extremely intoxicated. It may take longer than that time for them to detox. And in those cases, you can't go to court and have the arraignment continue. And that's just a very special exception that doesn't happen very often.
I guess my point, Mr. Chairman, is that it's in the trial that really all the facts are brought to bear on the situation, and that the investigation that the DFYS has to go through is not going to be nearly equal to the amount of information that's going to be obtained in the trial. And at that point, a kid that probably should be considered a juvenile, it's too late. They're already been charged as an adult. Mm.
So. Well, are there any other questions, Mr. Hines?
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry, I have to run.
That's all
okay.
Right. What's the wishes of the committee on dealing with this?
I noticed that the sponsor's staff is gesturing.
That's okay.
Yeah, sure.
I just wanted to clarify, I'm here for, my name is Jenny Murray, I'm a legislative aide to Representative Bundy. I just wanted to state for the record Representative Bundy's position. He, I believe, is fully in support, unwaveringly, for House Bill 100, the original House Bill 100. Some of his concerns regarding the committee substitute were that you're probably familiar with maybe some of the fiscal notes. The fiscal notes for the committee substitute will be much greater, much higher than those that addition to that, as far as the waiver, the reverse waiver, I'll key it as. In House Bill 100, there is a reverse waiver. If you commit such and such crimes, you will automatically go to adult court. But then the reverse waiver, you can be waivered back to juvenile court if, for example, you prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that you can be amenable to treatment by the age of 20. And the role of the judge, I would believe, as Representative Nordlund was saying, the role of the judge in the courts when things come out in trial, the role of the judge, I think, is an important thing to keep in mind when determining what's happening to a juvenile, because I think, as I'm sure we're all in agreement, the well-being of the juvenile is what we're thinking here. And I think the waiver process, as it is intact now, is a very important process that juveniles have to go through if they're going to be waived up to adult court, but it's also another important process in this bill if they're going to be waived back to a juvenile court. For example, if you have a juvenile that has, one example would be a juvenile that has been psychologically and physically maybe molested their whole entire life, end up murdering their stepfather, stepmother, etc. With Senate bill, the committee substitute, they would automatically be waived, probably, to adult court and tried, not guilty or guilty, depending on the situation, depending on if they've been harmed throughout the whole entire life. With House Bill 100, if the defense can prove during the trial that the juvenile has been under immense emotional strain, he's been traumatized, he's gone through a whole bunch of things at the hands, etc., of his stepfather, then if they can prove this kid is not a bad kid and he is amenable to treatment, then he can be waived back down to juvenile court and then be tried or taken care of through the juvenile system. So with 100, there is a catch. Instead of just relying upon the attorneys when the juvenile is charged, there's some sort of catch involved with House Bill 100 that wouldn't be there if with the CS. So I think that's the concern there, and I just thought I'd state that.
So are there any questions, Jenny?
I can be corrected if I got anything wrong.
Jenny, I realize that I'm asking you a question to see if Representative Bundy has told you the answer to this, or you can surmise it. But what you stated that Representative Bundy felt was that the fiscal note would be much greater with the committee substitute version than his. As I think we've established, there's probably going to be at least one and perhaps two additional hearings required under 100 as opposed to a particular. How does that equate to?
Well, I noticed that the committee substitute was, as Gail said, was very similar to the Senate Bill 54 version, the original version that Senator Halper had introduced. And the accompanying fiscal notes for that original Senate bill were much higher in comparison to House Bill 100. And I'm sure there are varying reasons for that, and I haven't actually delved into and asked the separate entities and departments what the reasons would be. But I particularly noted the fiscal notes for the Public Defenders Agency and the Office of Public Advocacy for those original bills. And those, of course, on House Bill 100, those are also the only fiscal notes that are not zeros. But I was just noting the dollar amounts, significantly greater.
What are they in the Senate one?
Well, this was the old this is the old Senate bill version.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see, the Public Defenders Agency for Senate Bill 54, which is similar to the CS, is for fiscal year 94, 155, I'm guessing, 1,000? 155,000, et cetera. For fiscal year 95, 151.4 thousand, and increasing upwards fiscal year 96, 155.9, and then steadily increasing.
Let me just... suffice to say, is it this public defender and OPA that you're referring to in terms
of? Yes, yes. The other fiscal notes were the same.
This
but
committee has had the opportunity to see sometimes that OPA and the public defender's philosophy gets involved in their fiscal notes.
As
so
we noted for our fiscal notes,
yeah.
Also. It's also
so other than that, would it be a fair statement to say that there would be more impact on the court with 100?
As far as the wavering process,
I just mean the total fiscal requirements to fund 100 as opposed to the committee substitute.
From the court's perspective or from the whole picture perspective?
Setting aside PD and OPA, from everybody's perspective.
I don't know.
All right, any other questions? No, I don't think we're gonna be able to do this anymore.
No.
All right, what I will endeavor to do is to reschedule this when Representative Bundy is here and deal with the issues that we have obviously got between the two approaches. And I'm not married to either one of them, but in fairness, they should be discussed. So. So with that in mind, we'll do it. And Jim, thank you very much.
Yeah. Couple good bills of
appreciate
yeah.
it.
Appreciate
yeah,
it.
We got a couple out anyway.
Have
so,
a good one.
All right.
With nothing further, we'll be adjourned.
Great.
Yes.
Are you going to be on the phone?
No, I'll stay.
Two out of three ain't bad.
Two out of three.